Today I was reminded of something that happened when I was at the Zen monastery, Tassajara. I was there for a few years, and after I was there for about a year, there was a new beginning of a new three-month practice period. And at the beginning of these practice periods, they were called retreats, there would be new people would come. Sometimes just for the 3 months, sometimes they'd come for a year or several years, but there'd be this time when people would arrive. And these two unrelated people, didn't know each other, arrived to begin at the same time. And they started the retreat, and like everyone else, probably about 40, 50 people there. And about a month or two or so into the retreat, I had a chance to have a conversation with these two different people. And first I talked to the woman, and I said, you know, how was it to be at the monastery? And she said, it's great. It's a wonderful place to be, and I feel like I finally can be alone. And then I talked to the man. How was it to be at the monastery? And he said, oh, it's so hard. I'm never alone. And so then I kind of thought that was kind of curious. I mean, the same location, same, everything was the same, pretty much, except one was felt so alone in a nice way, and the other felt never alone and not a nice way. So what turned out is that the woman had grown up in her own, when she grew up, in a family full of kids, and she left when she was 18 or something, and immediately got married and had kids of her own, had her own pack of kids. And finally they had grown up, and kids and maybe husband all went off, and so she could come down to the monastery. And it was the first time in her life that she had not been around such a tight quarters. And for her, the monastery was a place of lots of space, and she felt she could be finally alone. It was a contrast. And for the man, he had spent the last 20 years before coming down there living alone in Daly City, in the house there. And so for him, being alone, the contrast was now there's 40, 50 people all the time all around me. So the same location, same situation, experienced in very different ways. It wasn't that one was right and one was wrong. It's just that they were they had different backgrounds and conditioning that went into what their experience was like. And I thought about that. I was reminded of this today, because what probably most of you don't realize is how different you are from each other. And we see it. Teachers see it because you come in for meetings with us, and we meet one person, one universe, and then another person comes in, it's a different person, it's a different universe, it's a different whole thing. It's really wonderful to see. You know, it's kind of, you just gotta love everyone for who they are, because we're all so unique, uniquely wonderful, uniquely ourselves. And that part of the path of that we're on is to really be yourself, and not to be someone else's self. Maybe it's a cliche now, it's been said so many times, but I kind of delighted in this little cliche or something. Someone said, you might as well be yourself because everyone else is taken. And I feel very fortunate. When I started my Buddhist practice, I started in the Zen, in particular Zen tradition, where really the emphasis was just be yourself. That they said, you know, when you are you, Zen is Zen. And so this idea that you're not supposed to become something different, but somehow shed all the different ways which you are not yourself, or in conflict with yourself. But you know, what is this self, that when we're really ourselves? I think the assumption is that it's a kind of way of being in the world, being with ourselves, we're at ease with ourselves, or we're not in conflict, or not fighting, or not trying to prove something that we're something different than what we are. There's a kind of ability to be at rest or at peace or be contented or be just be. You don't have to be anything in particular, you can just be. And there are so many messages that we pick up from our society and family and our life experiences where it's not okay just to be. We have to prove ourselves, we have to fit into norms that are not our own. We feel like we're not enough for what is expected of us. And so we're always on our guard, or always defensive, or always trying to compensate, or upset, or angry, or critical of something, or of people around us. And so it's possible for the heart to be at peace with itself, for the heart to rest in itself, for the mind to be at peace. And perhaps the idea of peace or rest is not appealing to some of you because you love to be active and engaged and dance or whatever you do. And so peace in these Buddhists, all about being kind of couch potatoes. You know, they don't understand about being active. But it's not a matter of, you know, it's really a matter of kind of finding a place where how we act in the world, how we live our life, comes from a place that feels deeply, deeply satisfying and doesn't come from conflict, doesn't come from the kind of conflict or dissatisfaction that is often the fuel for desire, greed, aversion, hate, fear. And so to somehow be yourself enough so that you can come from, so there can be a feeling of satisfaction in our lives. So it's a little dangerous to be a teacher because we have to say something. And I'm fond of this Japanese Zen kind of idea that apparently in Japan, the equivalent of if you lie, in the West, you know, the Pinocchio's nose keeps growing if you lie. Apparently in Japan, your eyebrows keep growing. And so venerated old Zen masters have these big eyebrows, right? And so it's because a Zen master can never not lie. Because that's one lie after another. Because you can't really talk about reality, or can't really talk about truth, or you can't really say something. And sometimes I feel that way being a teacher, not because I can't say maybe what's true, but when I say something as a teacher, maybe the goal is to be at peace with yourself. Well, that word might not work for some of you. I had a great conversation with someone today where I asked, you know, what would it take to put down the burden you're carrying, burden of self or something? And that didn't work, for that person's, what person was dealing with. So I changed the image to, maybe it's not a matter of putting something down. Maybe it's that part of you is more like a caterpillar, and IRC is your cocoon, and it's going to be transformed into a butterfly. So so luckily I dodged the bullet there, right? You know, these Buddhists are always about putting things down and letting go, and you know, it depends on the image you use or the kind of metaphors you use or discussion use. So we end up saying something and it sounds like, you know, now I have to live up to that. So you have to feel sorry for us teachers. It's so hard. The eyebrows grow. So with that as a kind of consumer be aware introduction. The for me, the notion of peace has been very meaningful as a kind of journey or a goal or experience in this path. And probably one of the first experiences I had that was kind of, I don't know if it led me, certainly didn't lead me to Buddhism, but in retrospect I realized kind of the first kind of taste of a different way of being was when I was 11 years old, 10 or 11, maybe 10 or 11, and I took the bus back and forth to school. It was a public school, public bus in Italy, and they'd have the driver and the conductor who sold the tickets. And I lived near the end of the bus route, so near the end, the conductor would sit in a certain place near the front of the bus, and he would tally up all the tickets that he had done for that trip or that day. How many round trip, how many one way, how many senior tickets, how many kids tickets, I don't know, just all these different categories. He had all these bundles of tickets that he would spin out of these coils. And then he had this ledger, and he would write down what he'd sold. And I discovered that if I sat in the seat behind him when he did that and looked over his shoulder at him doing his tallies, I would start feeling really good. I would feel kind of full, it was a feeling of fullness, of kind of being very present, just that everything was good in the world, no problems, kind of my mind got quiet. And I just would watch him do his ledger. And I had no idea. I didn't know. I didn't think about what was going on. I just knew that if I sat there, so every day taking this bus home, I would sit there so I could watch him. And what I was going, what was happening now many years later, what was happening was I was getting concentrated. And my various thoughts and machinations and desires and busyness of my mind, whatever was going on, concerns, homework, whatever, kind of fell away. And I was just absorbed in just that simple act. And somehow one of the words for concentration is to be collected. So to be unified, so the different parts of who we are not at conflict or not racing around, but everything's kind of settled on this one thing. So that was a kind of a touchstone for me, that experience. Another touchstone for me was when I was 18. I traveled around France by myself, and I ended up at a Catholic monastery, I suppose, called, somewhat famous, called Mont Saint-Michel. And it's on the, kind of, you go across the plains of, I guess it's Brittany, Normandy. And you come to, I guess, the Atlantic. Suddenly it's all flat, and suddenly this thing, it looks like a Disneyland palace, kind of rises up out of the plains. And it's this monastery on an island just off the coast. That's just a bridge out to the island. It's very, very close, small bridge. And I spent a couple of days there, and I got a tour of the monastery. And the top of the hill, the monastery was kind of built on a hill, and on the top of the hill, inside the monastery, was the original one-room chapel that the monastery then eventually was built around over 1,000 years or something. Big place. And that one-room chapel, so they gave us a tour of the monastery all over, and then we came to that, brought us into that one-room chapel, stone little thing that. And when we walked in there, something shifted inside of me. And I wasn't confused. Maybe I was confused. But I'd never experienced such peace and stillness as I had in that room. But it wasn't really in the room. It was in my chest. Where did my chest end? Where did it begin? Where was the room? Where was me? But I just felt this, you know, fullness of peace, of settledness. Like there was nothing, everything was right. Everything was no, nothing, there was no conflict, no issue, no, it was just peace. And I had never had that kind of peace in my life before, and to experience that as a possibility by walking into a room was quite something. And so then I tried to linger in the room as long as I could. The group left and I stayed. And then I had a little bit more inkling what was going on, all this, before I really started doing serious meditation. I started doing some meditation, but I lived alone for a week on a farm, taking care of the dairy cows, and when I was 21. And I'd never been alone before that way for 7 days. And steadily over the 7 days, taking care of the cows and being alone, I didn't see anybody except the mail carrier in the distance one day. I started to get clearer and clearer in my mind. Everything started to, when I looked at things, they kind of sparkle. Like everything was kind of stood out in highlight. And that was nice. But what was particularly nice for me was that I became acutely aware of my thoughts. But kind of in the same way as looking at the objects around me and they were sparkling, it was kind of like my thoughts were like maybe sparkling. Like it wasn't like, I don't remember what I was thinking. It's probably nothing of any interest. But just the fact that I was thinking, that somehow that they like, each one was like this bubble or this crystal that could appear, and I could see it with such clarity. And I'd never seen my thoughts with such clarity before. Just the fact that I was thinking and that there were individual thoughts that arose and there they were. And I had this tremendous sense of intimacy with myself and my life, and I never had this intimacy with myself. I really felt like I knew or was in touch. And then the people whose farm it was came back, and it vanished. And because it vanished, because as soon as they came back, my social concerns, my social selves, talking and all the you know, back and forth, and the impact of that, and feelings, emotions, all this stuff kind of came back. And then I understood that there was a way of being where the mind wasn't caught up in all the thoughts and ideas and feelings. The thoughts and ideas and feelings could be there, but there was kind of a space around them, this intimacy, this, I don't know if distance is the right word. And that experience then became part of the very strong piece of the motivation to get involved in Buddhism and in serious meditation practice, because the task was for me was to learn how to be alone with others, how to have that intimacy, that presence, that peace, while I'm with other people, and with other people not getting caught up in all the social kind of games and stories and things that go on. So how to be alone with others, how to be present without being caught in it all. And then the last story. So then at some point I made my way to San Francisco Zen Center. And one of the formative experiences there was sitting in the Zendo, the meditation hall, in the basement. And if I was going to tell you what was meaningful, it was and what kind of had an impact on me, an imprint on me, it was the stillness and the silence of the room. It was sitting still and upright for hours and days and months at a time in this room, not all day long, but just going back there, you know, couple times a day and sitting there. Sometimes we'd have 1 day sittings. Occasionally we'd had 7 day retreats there. But sitting there in that stillness and in that silence of this room, it wasn't that silent. There were city streets and all kinds of noises outside the window in San Francisco, but it felt silent. And what I discovered in that stillness and silence was that the stillness and silence wasn't just in the room. It was like the stillness and silence of the room and sitting upright was that my mind didn't necessarily stop thinking, But there was a lot of room in my mind for my thoughts. There was all this space, open space in the mind for those thoughts, whatever was going on. And again, I had this feeling of intimacy of being present. And I was neurotic. I had a lot of fear, a lot of guilt, all kinds of thoughts and about myself that weren't very nice, a lot of suffering. But it was all held. So it wasn't like I had to get rid of that. It was all held in this broad stillness or silence or spaciousness, whatever the word of the room, but really it was in the spaciousness and stillness of my mind. And what I learned is that the mind can be many different ways, the experience of awareness or the mind. And it's possible for the mind to be very small and everything is claustrophobic. A lot of thoughts racing and rushing, and we're kind of living in the middle of them, negotiating and bouncing between our thoughts. And it just, you know, there's very little space, the speed of it, there's very little gap between one thought and the next, and they race on top of each other. And they all seem so important and heavy, and we're close in with them and reacting to them. And it's also possible to have thoughts in a big mind, or a mind that has lots of space and lots of room, kind of like being in a big, big, beautiful, open grove of trees or cathedral or something, and you just feel all the space and lots of room. And so that what the mind is, how the mind is experienced, is flexible, fluid. It's not like the mind is not like a thing. And so we experience it differently depending on how the mental activity in the mind is operating. And so sometimes it can feel very small and sometimes very big. And so this idea of an expansive mind, open mind, wide mind, or a mind that wasn't picking things up. There'd be thoughts and ideas, but there was a stillness where it didn't seem necessary to get involved with anything. And this was a very important point for me, and maybe was I would do these retreats, and after, 7-day retreats at Zen Center, and they were challenging for me in many different ways. Tremendous challenges I had. But sometime after 5-6 days or something of sitting there, meditating, there would come a time where my mind was a little bit settled down, a little bit expansive and present in a nice way. So a very satisfying feeling. I'm here. I'm not being pushed around by my thoughts, I'm not chasing my thoughts, I'm just here. I'm still thinking, but I'm not caught by them so much. And then something would happen that would elicit a particular kind of thought inside, or a particular reaction or emotion. So maybe I had my seat in the meditation hall, and I'd gone out to go to the bathroom, and I would come back, and someone was sitting in my seat. My seat. That was mine. It was assigned to me. This is a problem. Where do I sit now? I'm a Zen student. I'm supposed to sit. But I would see the reaction, maybe the anger or the fear or the thought that arise. And I would say to myself, I'd see, what would I rather do? Get caught up in my anger or my fear or my concerns, my problem solving? Or settle back and stay in this peaceful state that I had? I saw I had a choice. Now, I knew that in my daily life, I often didn't see the place of choice. I would just get, someone sitting in my chair and, But because of the work of the retreat, 5, 6, 7 days of the retreat, I could see that I had something, my mind had something, my inner life had something that was kind of precious, very satisfying. Peacefulness, openness, calmness, spaciousness, stillness. I don't know what the right word, you know, what word speaks to you. And it was much more satisfying than getting caught up in my story, mind telling stories and problem solving and my anger and my concerns. And it was just like obvious. I didn't have to pick up, and obviously I didn't want to get involved in those things again, right then and there. It was like it's obvious, as if you put your hand close to the stove and you don't take it all the way to the stove, you take it off right away. No one has to tell you to do that. You lean on the stove and your hand's burning and you wait for the cook and come and tell you, by the way, it's probably not a good idea. The cook's in charge, so you have to wait. You move your hand, right? It's just so obvious. So it's that kind of obviousness that I was experiencing. It's obvious I don't get involved in those kinds of thoughts. It's obvious I don't get pick up those kinds of feelings. There's something much more better going on. There's better satisfaction here. And in that movement, I would let go, or not pick up is probably a better word. I wouldn't pick up, or I'd let go of the tendency to get involved in the mental activity, the emotional activities that would cause me to lose this more satisfying state that I was in. So I hope this makes some sense. So there are different minds, different ways the minds can be. In some ways our minds can be involve a lot of suffering. In some ways our minds can be without suffering. And so our task is to try to begin understanding what goes on in our minds and how our minds work, if what we want to do is to find a way of living without suffering. So for me, I like to call that a life of peace. And deep abiding peace, the heart's at peace. And then we begin to investigate and get curious about how all this works. And so we come in. One way to do it is meditation practice. And it's probably best not to think of meditation practice as a clear linear path from, suffering to bliss. So promising this meditation, I'll just go to that retreat, sit down. I'm sure I can follow simple instructions. I'll just follow my breath. And I have a lot to do in my life. It's a 7-day retreat, but I can probably get it over with in 3 and then go on to the other things I want to do with my life. I'll nail it. But, it's not a linear path, but rather it's a path of meeting yourself, being with yourself, discovering who you are. And the process of doing that, learning to have more peace, be at peace with yourself. But to do that well, it's helpful to have some modicum of calm, of being connected. So this 16 stages of Anapanasati is a part of this path. So, there are other paths, other ways of describing it, so you don't have to get too caught up in that you necessarily have to follow this way, but I think it's a lot of wisdom to this description of either a path or how to understand ourselves. And it begins by using the breath as a way of training ourselves to be a little bit more present than we usually are, to be more be mindful, develop our mindfulness. Very simple, just connect to your breath, get to know it. And then as you get to know your breathing, either as a practice or as a side effect of getting more present, becoming aware of your body, waking up in your body, becoming more aware of being embodied, being connected in your body. Body is a very important instrument of our life. It is our life. And then as we settle in more and we've become aware of the holding patterns, the tension we have, it's good to relax. It's easier to meet ourselves and understand ourselves if we're relaxed, because if you're agitated, it's like you know, it's like trying to look through the surface of a pond, and if it's all churned up in the wind, you can't see through. But the surface gets clear, you can see. So if your mind is all agitated, you can't see very far. So it's good to calm down. And it's a big deal to begin to relax. It takes a lot of trust. It takes a lot of learning. It takes a while to really learn that it's okay, and it's okay to put down some of the concerns that agitate us. So at some point, perhaps, we are able to let go, to relax, and the experience of relaxation, if you pay attention to what the after effects are, feel good. There's a kind of delight or well-being or a little bit of nice energy that comes from that feeling of relaxation. And so the next step in the path of the 16 stages is to experience, the word is joy. And one of the ways to understand this is that there's probably much more sense of well-being that you can tune into than you usually do. Our mind has a tremendous capacity to have blinders on or to select certain things which are important that it's concerned with and miss out on much of the else that's going on. And my guess is that most of us can look around and feel there's much more pleasure and delight and nice things going on than we usually realize. And in particular, if we're beginning to relax and settle in and being present, it's helpful, it's nourishing, to begin to notice that pleasure. Notice that sense of well-being that comes from settling in, relaxing the body. And as we settle in and the body relaxes and we feel this well-being, then it becomes a little bit more clear, easier to notice and highlight the activities of the mind. Just like in my story of being in the Zendo, at some point after 6 or 7 days, there was this big mind, a spacious mind, where I could see what was going on in my mind more clearly. And so I didn't have to pick up things that normally I would have gotten involved in. So then as we become more aware of the mental activities, this meeting ourselves, more intimate with ourselves, we see that our mental activity sometimes is tense, is straining, a lot of energy there, and that perhaps it isn't necessary to apply so much mental energy and effort and to thinking about the past or the future or defending ourselves or trying to explain ourselves one more time or whatever all the things we do in our mind, all the wantings we want and desires. And so then the instructions are then relax the mind, relax the mental activity. It's a lot easier to say than to do. Again, it's a big learning to learn the trust that it's okay to either put down some of these things that we've been working out for a lifetime, or allow it to kind of metamorphize into a butterfly. Butterfly is very light. So then we come to the third tetrad, which is a topic for today. And the third tetrad begins breathing in when experiences the mind. Breathing out when experiences the mind. And the mind here is distinguished, is it something different than mental activity. The mental activity of thoughts, desires, aversions, ruminations, even emotions that arise in the mind or the heart, wherever they, those are more like the content of the mind, what goes on in the mind. But the mind in this system is more like the state of mind, the state of consciousness, or the mood of the mind as a container for it all. So sometimes the mind can be narrow and tight, and sometimes the mind can feel expansive and relaxed. The mind can feel tense, and sometimes it can feel relaxed. Sometimes the mind can feel concentrated, and sometimes the mind feels scattered. It's all over the place. Sometimes it can seem our mind, the general state of the mind, can be strongly colored by the moods or the desires or the emotional reactivity going on. So if there's a lot of desire, sometimes the mind is colored by that, by the lust or something. If there's a lot of hate, the whole flavor of the mind is colored by the hate. And you can kind of see it in other people sometimes. Sometimes you can see someone walking down the street, you don't even know them, and they just seems like a dark cloud over them or something. They're just like, you just feel the hate, and it just feels like you better get out of the way. And you see someone else walking down the street, and they're just happy-go-lucky and happy and smiley and open, and just you feel like there's a whole different mood to the person. So the mind, the citta, is more like the overall mood of the mind or the state of the mind. So rather than becoming aware of the content of the mind, the activity of the mind within the mind, at some point we become aware of the quality of the mind. And this is a huge change, I believe, and for many people, because mostly, I believe, for a lot of people, our attention is usually focused on the things that concern us, the things that are important for us, the things that entertain us, the things that we want. You know, it's particular, we focus on things, and so we don't notice the environment in which our thinking, our concerns are occurring. It'd be a little bit like coming into this room here and maybe you're like an interior decorator and you're only concerned about the colors of the zafus and zabatons and how it matches people's clothes and the color of their clothes and you kind of, that's all, you know, everything's like people's, the colors and how they fit and you know, just always, that's all it's all about, this room. And then for some reason, the interior decorator kind of stops doing that and looks around and realizes that it's like the third day of a retreat. And boy, is it quiet in here. There's a stillness in this room. And that stillness, the person hadn't noticed because the person was so concerned with the color scheme. That's a poor example probably, but so there can be a shift of where our attention goes from our particular concerns, whatever they might be, to how the mind holds it, how the mind holds it all, or how it occurs. And so we get to feel what the mind is like, experience the mind. And the classic instructions around this are to know, for example, if the mind is characterized by desire, lust, recognize that's the case. If it's characterized by hate, recognize that's the case. If it's characterized by delusion or confusion, recognize that's the case. Or if it's not characterized by those things, recognize the absence of those things. But then I think it gets more interesting. It says, when the mind is scattered, know that it's scattered, fragmented, kind of jumping around. When the mind is contracted, constricted, know it. It's beautiful the way it says. It says, just know it. It doesn't say, know it and be upset. Just know it. Just, this is how it is. Because we're always meeting ourselves. We're here to meet ourselves. It's a kind of an act of compassion and care to meet ourselves, to find out what's here. There's no need to be critical of any of it. And then it goes further and it says, when the mind is expansive, know it, or spacious, know it as spacious or expansive. When the mind is composed, concentrated, unified, know it as composed or concentrated. When the mind is free, not caught in all its concerns, recognize that it's free. So it's possible to feel the quality of the mind, or the tradition actually treats the mind almost the same as the heart. So we have to, in English, we have to choose one or the other. If you prefer the word heart, use that instead. And I feel that one of the most precious things going, and the most precious things to care for, is the quality of our hearts, the quality of our minds. And to be the caretakers of that quality, to notice, what is the quality of the mind? Now, it takes some settling in and time to actually start noticing that we have a mind. We might notice we have thoughts, but to know that we have this kind of holding tank for the mental activity, and to kind of begin appreciating this container, or the holder, or the spaciousness of it. So in this third tetrad, it begins by saying, breathing in, one experiences one's mind. Breathing out, one experiences one's mind. Sometimes I think maybe it's almost, might be useful to say, instead of mind, breathing in, one experiences the quality of one's awareness. Breathing out, one experiences the quality of one's awareness. That which, the awareness, it holds the experience. And then it says, breathing in, one has satisfaction in one's mind. Breathing out, one is satisfied with one's mind. This idea of being satisfied or pleased with what you find, with how you are. And I don't know if you know what satisfied, pleased is the best translation. But somehow that it's satisfying, it's meaningful, how the quality of the mind, the quality of the heart, and to allow oneself to feel satisfied by that, or enjoy it, or gladdened by it, appreciate this. If it's to be appreciated, appreciate it. Sometimes people are so busy feeling, like this is my case when I was in the first years of practice, if I did something, anything at all, in my infinite wisdom, I knew that I was doing it wrong. Didn't matter what. That was just the default. Of course, if I did it, it was wrong. And so the idea of being able to appreciate and enjoy and feel pleasure or satisfaction in myself was kind of a very foreign idea, that I could do that. But slowly, slowly, that opened up for me to feel a satisfaction in the mind, the quality of the inner life. Sometimes instead of calling it mind or awareness, I like calling this thing the inner life, the quality of the inner life. So experience the mind, then experience satisfaction in the mind, and then it says, the word is samadhi. Breathing in, one samadhis one's mind. Breathing out, one samadhis one's mind. And I think, like Richard, I think I prefer not to use the word concentration to translate samadhi, because I think it suggests, for some people, kind of this bearing down, laser focus, one-pointed, you know, there's just, you know, and a little bit too dualistic, like, I'm going to bear down and focus on that thing there and be concentrated. My preferred translation for samadhi is to be composed. To compose oneself. And if you play the etymology game, the etymology of the word samadhi and the etymology of the word compose is the same. Calm is the same as a sam, with, and the pose, means like to stand, is the same as the di of samadhi, to stand with. And maybe it's a little bit creative, but that's what the Indian Buddhists do. They're creative with their etymology, so I'm allowed. So to be composed, I like composed because composed is that it's a, um, It's something you do with your whole being. You don't, not with a laser focus of the mind. You settle and you compose yourself around your experience. So to compose yourself on your breath has a very different effect than to concentrate on the breath. And for me, at least, concentrating on my breath is a little bit fragile. But to compose myself on the breath feels more grounded or more somehow, you know, has certain kind of subtleness to it. So whatever you're going to concentrate on, think about how you might compose yourself on that experience. Gather yourself around, unify yourself on the experience. So with, and one of the took me a long time to appreciate that you can't really get strongly concentrated or strongly composed or unified without feeling, being relaxed and a modicum of being happy, having a sense of well-being. I can't tell you how many times I was miserable and I thought, if I just concentrate, I'm going to bear down and blast out of it or something. And I don't know if that works so well. What works is to relax, be here in a nice way. Don't try to fight what's here. Settle into what's here. Be willing to be here with what's here. And to start feeling some, at least a modicum of joy or well-being, satisfaction. And in that satisfaction and well-being, then it's possible to let the mind get composed and settled. Then there's something nice that holds it, that supports that movement of settling in. And then comes one of the first climax in this great journey of these 16 steps. So experiencing the mind, satisfying the mind, composing the mind, then it's liberating the mind, freeing the mind. And I think it's best not to think of this as being the final liberation of full enlightenment or something, but rather the much more ordinary freedoms that are much simpler that we can experience. I don't know what a good example is, it's really ordinary, but you could probably have the experience here at the retreat where you see your mind beginning to have a desire or an aversion and you decide, I'll leave it alone. I won't go there. Won't get involved. You see the mind's desire for seconds and you're already full and you realize it's not so helpful for me to have seconds. I'll leave it alone. And that leaving it alone is a kind of freedom. The mind begins to think about certain thing, leave it alone. Don't pick it up, or if you picked it up, put it down. The mind becomes setting itself free. So the mind that is composed, that's settled, there's a fullness to it and presence of mind, that sooner or later will have the capacity to begin to see that there is choice between what we get involved in and what we don't. And I think this is part of the real heart of Buddhist practice and part of the function of mindfulness is to place us in that place of choice where we have a choice between choosing freedom versus choosing being caught. And to actually be able to have a visceral feeling or sense or of what it's the difference between being caught or gripping something and putting it down, or pushing away and relaxing, or pulling away and relaxing. To see we have a choice. And first we see it in small ways. Maybe the small way is you have your favorite walking meditation place here and you've walked in the same place for 2 days. So it's your place, right? And one day you have to go pee before you go out to walk, and so you're a little bit late. And someone is walking in your place. Don't they realize that this is, you own that place. How could they? This is a travesty. This is disrespectful. How could they be so whatever? So it's possible to go out there and see someone in your place and watch in the mind the birth of mine. This is my place. Or the birth of that person is disrespecting me. Or I need to write a letter to the president of IRC about how we need to have lanes that we write our names on. And we see the mind beginning to go in this direction, and we see we have a choice. And if we see they have the choice, then maybe we can say, not now, I don't need to do this. Or maybe we don't have a choice. The horse is out of the barn. The thoughts are going to go off. And maybe where the choice is a choice not to berate ourselves for getting angry. Or maybe we get one more time we berate ourselves because we're angry. Here I am again, I'm angry, I'm in meditation retreat, I'm not being a good Buddhist. And, you know, this is one more time, I'm just doing it terribly. So maybe that you can step back and say, I have a choice at least not to add any more arrows to that. So to step back, like Richard said the other day, to where the choice is, where you can leave it alone and put it down. So to experience the mind, to feel some satisfaction, to know some place of that's satisfying, meaningful for you, some quality of awareness of heart or mind that's meaningful, be in touch with it, to treasure it, to value it. And then from that space, being willing to settle in, to compose oneself on one's experience here and now. And then begin appreciating that there is possibility for freedom here. Perhaps sometimes in very small ways, and sometimes in really big ways. There could be issues of self-identity that you've carried with you all your life, that you feel like you have to be this kind of person and prove yourself to the world, that you have to. And it may be very frightening even to put it down. But then you see a day comes when you see you have a choice. And you see that you can also put that down. Or you don't have to pick it up when it arrives. And it turns your world upside down because your whole world's been dependent on that identity. And there's a feeling of real, dramatic freedom and joy and ease. Or sometimes even a little disorientation for a while because it's so new. But there's small movements of freedom, and there's big movements of freedom. And a lot how big the movements of freedom are depend a lot on how settled and composed we can get. And you don't have to be settled and composed, but as you do this practice, there are times when that might happen. And then it gives you a chance to see yourself in bigger ways. So then I'll end by saying that your mind has concerns. And it's probably had concerns for a long time. Some concerns have been pretty consistent, some concerns are new. And the concerns that you have, chances are pretty good, have put on blinders, so you see the world through the filter, through the framework of those concerns that you have. And that for most of us, we take that for granted, that this is how the universe is, this is what it means, that because we see it through that framework of our concerns. In a retreat like this, it helps if you put a question mark at the beginning and the end of any concerns you have. Just, you know, like just at the end of any concern, anything that's a concern, maybe at the end of your concern, whatever you're thinking, add the word maybe. Maybe. And to be open that there may be another way. There might be other things you can open to, other ways of being here. Maybe you don't have to see yourself and the world through the concerns that you've carried with you for a long time. Maybe you can soften around them. You might try just adding the word maybe. And see if that kind of lightens what goes on. Supports you here. It helps you kind of, if it's a maybe after your concerns, then maybe it's easier to kind of let them go so you can come back and be here in the present moment more fully. Maybe. So we're still on the first half side of the retreat, and I really appreciate a lot your practice and how it's going for all of you. It's a beautiful thing what you're doing, and I would just, if I may, I'd like to encourage you to safeguard your practice carefully. Stay close to your practice, stay close to yourself, and allow the kind of staying in your close to your practice and yourself, let that help you settle in more and safeguard your practice, care for it, love it, and give yourself over to the practice a little more fully than, if there are ways you can give yourself over to it more fully, please do, because this is a precious time, wonderful time. And in that, and if you do that for yourself, you also become a support for everybody else, because it translates to everyone, kind of creating a better container for everyone supporting each other here on the retreat. We had a request that, I think maybe because we're settling in now, that some of the indoor bells, those Tibetan chimes, it's probably time to soften them, not have them so loud, because it's probably not needed to be so loud anymore. And now that we're all getting kind of quiet. So as you go walk around the building, make it a little bit quieter. And this evening, for this evening, you're welcome to leave some questions on the bulletin board again. And this evening, Richard will be here to answer the questions, so he'll answer one or two of them. So, thank you, and enjoy your rest of your day.